Welcome to History Counts. History provides the roadmap to the future. If you want to know where you're going, you have to understand where you've been. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Every election, millions of Americans express frustration at the choice between the two major parties. Some go so far as to describe the two major parties as one beast with two different heads. These critics say that the parties may have slightly different philosophies and objectives, but fundamentally, they are both accountable to the same moneyed interests. In today's program, we're going to consider a tradition of democratic government which is quite different from the choices presented by the two major parties. This tradition goes back a long way, and it's called populism. So please stay tuned for the next edition of History Counts, Populism, the Third Way. Welcome back to History Counts. This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Today we're going to discuss the history of democracy, as particularly embodied in the concept of populism. To help us understand populism, its meaning, its past, and its application to the present and future, we're very fortunate to have as our guest Adrian Kuzminski, author of Fixing the System, A History of Populism, Ancient and Modern. Mr. Kuzminski is a resident scholar in philosophy at Hartwick College in Oneonta, New York. In addition to his academic work, Mr. Kuzminski has long been involved in politics and civic work. He served on the National Platform Committee of the Green Party. He's also run for political office and has been an environmental activist for many years. His most recent book, Pyrrhonism, How the Ancient Greeks Reinvented Buddhism, was published by Lexington Books in 2008. Mr. Kuzminski, thanks very much for being with us today.
Sure, you're welcome.
What is populism, and why is it called the third way?
Well, I think the two ways are sort of what most people think of, the left and the right. And the left in this country in recent decades has seen big government as the kind of antidote to the abuses of big business. And on the other hand, I think the right has advocated free enterprise, limited government, and deregulation, which we've also been very familiar with in recent decades. So the populists aren't interested in big business or big government. They're interested in the decentralization of political and economic power. So it's a very different take, and it's really a way of thinking outside the box, a way of thinking that was quite widespread in the United States through the 19th century.
Would you say that the present system of government is a democratic?
No, it is not. People use that word, and that word is bandied about a lot. We do not live in a democracy. Technically, I suppose we live in a plutocracy, really, a plutocratic oligarchy, I would say.
You use the phrase plebiscite plutocracy to describe our elections.
Yeah, democracy to most people means the right to vote, you know, the right to go to a voting booth periodically and vote for a slate of candidates. This is a far cry from real democracy, which in ancient times, in ancient city-states, and more recently in New England town meetings and other places, has been face-to-face local self-rule, self-determination in local assemblies. That is real democracy, not what we have, a symbolic situation where we vote on candidates that are largely, you know, pre-selected by the powers that be, and most people don't have much or if any input into that.
And the powers that be would be what?
The powers that be would be the kind of, I don't know what you'd call it, the kind of money political structure, you know, the whole thing of lobbyists. And I mentioned plutocracy a minute ago. We have basically a money system. I mean, you need to raise huge quantities of money to run for anything other than local office. And therefore, you know, the people that are represented at the upper levels in state governments and at the federal level are really the campaign contributors. Those are the people that are represented. And the voters are represented only, I would say, in a secondary sense.
Well, you're talking about the idea of local assemblies. Doesn't this tie into the Thomas Jefferson's concept of a ward republic that you write about?
Oh, absolutely. That's where I started out. I came across Jefferson's. He wrote these letters late in life after he retired to Monticello. He had an extensive correspondence, and he came up with this idea of ward republics, which had been actually kicking around for quite a while in his mind, I think, even in an earlier time. But he said at one point that his idea of local assemblies was, if this could be realized as the basis of American government, that would really complete the American Revolution. He felt the American Revolution was incomplete, and as probably some of our listeners know, he advocated a periodic kind of purging or a periodic kind of some sort of revolution or reconsideration of our system every so often. And he clearly felt that what had been achieved in the revolution was incomplete.
In a ward republic, how large would be the most local assembly?
Well, you know, it's whatever the size is determined by the number of people that can carry on business in a face-to-face assembly. And that can be fairly large. That can be up into the hundreds or even thousands. I mean, the ancient Athenian assembly was actually incredibly, several thousand people could participate. And, of course, they had a kind of a screening committee. They had a kind of a council that set the agenda and things like that. And people served on these kinds of committees by lot. But it can be quite large. But the key thing is you have to have face-to-face interactions, which is exactly what's missing in our kind of political campaigns, which are really mass media events. They're not face-to-face. You're not making a judgment on your personal experience of a candidate, except at the local level, with few exceptions.
In the local assembly, then the average person could come in and he'd have a right to speak at the rostrum to introduce a proposal.
Exactly. The local assembly is a place where you exercise full citizenship rights. You could make a motion. You can second a motion. You can nominate somebody. Whereas in most places, with some exceptions, and New England town meetings being the most obvious in this country, you can go often to a local meeting. I can go to in New York State. I live in upstate New York. You can go to a town board meeting, but you're a petitioner there. You can, if they deign to let you speak, you can speak, but you don't have a vote even in that kind of situation.
And as I understand it, Jefferson envisioned something like a pyramid structure where you'd have a local assembly at your neighborhood level, and you would elect delegates which would go to successively higher assemblies?
Exactly. It's called confederal democracy. This is a fascinating thing, and one of the great unsolved problems in politics is how you take face-to-face local democracy to the grassroots and how you kind of moderate that or mediate that through broader coordinating institutions and have a bottom-up structure, whereas we have a top-down structure.
So under Jefferson's system, the guy down the block might be elected as my representative to, say, a county assembly, and then he would have to come periodically back and participate in my neighborhood assembly and confront me?
You would elect a representative to your county assembly, say, who might be the guy down the block. But this is somebody that would have to present himself or herself to you at a local assembly, a town meeting. You could question this person. There would be other candidates, presumably, and the determination would be made. One of the most interesting things here is that I think there was a deliberate effort made by Madison and others in the Constitutional Convention to sever the link between local democracies, town meetings and so forth, communities, and higher levels of government by establishing a system of representation that did not represent the communities, but rather through large electoral districts. The idea was that a state representative or a federal representative would represent a mass of people, of voters. And so therefore that, if you think of your congressperson, right, that something like 600,000 people are represented, which means that in effect nobody is really represented very effectively, and no communities are represented very effectively, so that communities are kind of at the mercy of the larger socio-political forces and are often overrun by them in our society.
Well, now in your book, you not only talk about the political aspect of democracy, but you place a lot of emphasis on the economic aspect of democracy, and particularly the idea that democracy is not compatible with great disparities of wealth. Could you talk about the ancient Greek Thales of Chalcedon and his views on this issue?
Well, yes. In Aristotle's Politics, there is a section about this fellow named, this is the only knowledge we have of him, Thales of Chalcedon, and he made the point, and Aristotle quotes it, that you can't have a democracy unless the citizens are more or less economically independent of one another. If you have a situation where wealth is concentrated in very few hands, most people then are going to end up being the economic dependents of those who have the wealth. And therefore, they don't really have, they're not in a position to have an independent political judgment, you know.
It's like in the late Roman Republic when the wealthy people got control of these large plantations and the Roman citizens became peons.
We're in a situation, I think, very similar to that, analogously to the late Roman Republic, where we have large kind of, in a way, kind of we're moving towards a kind of dynasticism. We see this, with the you know, the, I don't know, the Kennedys, the Bushes, the Clintons. Suddenly we have these sort of family things. So we have, this was true in ancient Rome, and you have, you know, Pompey and Caesar, and these were large, these were families that had concentrated wealth and were able to influence what was a very similar political process to ours, a process that was, people ran for mass elections, and you need a lot of money to compete.
So you can't have people that are extremely rich who can control the rest of the people. You don't want people so poor that they're basically pawns of the ruling group. How do people achieve some degree of economic independence?
Well, this is the thing. In the old days, in the pre-industrial era, up to maybe 200, 250 years ago, the major source of wealth was land. So, and populists, reformers of an earlier period, like an English, 17th century English political theorist named James Harrington, advocated the redistribution of land. And this was also something that was done in the Roman Republic. They tried to do this as well. And so if you can redistribute land in the old days, then you could give everybody basically a farm, kind of like the frontier in the American West, the homestead. You know, you can give people that kind of a resource, then you can create a widespread ownership of enough resources so that people can be relatively, not completely obviously, but relatively self-sufficient, or self-sufficient enough to be politically independent.
So the idea is that everybody independently can at least get a subsistence, so he's not beholden for survival
to
someone else?
Well, or even more, you know, more, subsistence sounds kind of dreary, I guess, but more than subsistence, even a decent, wholesome way of life with maybe even some luxuries. But land was the old sort of standard of wealth, but beginning with the Industrial Revolution, the new standard of wealth is no longer land, but is credit, or access to credit. And, of course, we see this in the news all the time. We're having a credit crisis and a credit crunch and so forth and so on. But if you can access credit in the modern society, then you can have access to resources. And, you know, I think most people who are listening to this, you know, have a mortgage or have an education loan or a student loan or a credit card loan or whatever, and the only place most people can get resources or capital now is by borrowing it, and the terms of borrowing capital are pretty onerous. You have to pay a high interest rate, often called usury, and most of the benefit of that goes to the creditor rather than the lender.
Well, let's talk about our money system. It seems to be central to a populist analysis. What is the effect on our democratic system of the current money system, which is represented by the Bank of England or the U.S. Federal Reserve?
Well, first of all, we have a privatized, most people, I think, are not aware of this, but we have a privatized monetary system. Most of the money that is created by the banking system. The Federal Reserve is a kind of holding company for the major banks. You know, it's their way of regulating themselves, and obviously they haven't done a very good job of it recently.
Yeah, I was really surprised that this system came out of the 1688 revolution in England. When the Bank of England was established, you say that essentially the revolutionaries, the rebels, transferred the right to create money from the government to a group of private people.
Well, that's right. Before that, the money was mostly the coin of the realm. You know, the king would issue coins with a stamp on them, and you had what economists call commodity money. Gold, silver, precious metals, and usually that was under the control of the sovereign traditionally. But with the development of sort of trade and the discovery of America, and first in Holland and then later in England, you had the rise of a kind of commercial activity on a very large scale, a scale that had not been seen since antiquity, and eventually even surpassed those levels. So that the idea of credit, of going into debt, borrowing money to make investments in the future is really something that did not exist in traditional kind of feudal early modern society.
So instead of the government just creating money and putting in circulation, now the government essentially has to pay for the money that it issues.
Exactly. The deal that was made was that a private banking syndicate, a lot of the shareholders were Dutch bankers. There was kind of an alliance, and of course William of Orange came to England in the Glorious Revolution. He was the sort of Dutch ruler and became the King of England, and James II, the Catholic monarch, was kicked out, and that was the so-called Glorious Revolution. But what it was really about, to a large extent, was bringing to this privatized banking system, establishing it in England, so that the Bank of England was given the kind of a monopoly over managing the British national debt and allowed the British to create a national debt. And then the banking system issued a kind of currency, the pound, on the basis of his debt, and was able to collect the interest on this. And this is sort of the model for our system. This is much admired by Alexander Hamilton, for example, who called this the English system, and a large part of his agenda was to introduce this into the United States.
And you alluded that the debate over whether we should have such a system was very active in the 19th century. But since the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913, the issue seems to have disappeared. Everybody seems to accept it as the way things have to be.
During the Civil War, the federal government issued greenbacks, which were a kind of fiat money issued by the government, not by the private banking system, which was quite a startling thing. It was very successful in many respects.
So Lincoln was really bucking that trend of the privatization of the money supply?
He was bucking a trend of the privatization of the money supply. And after the Civil War, the bankers and the financial interests in New York kind of got together, and they kind of forced the United States to go back onto the gold standard and phased out the greenbacks. And we had a kind of long deflationary period, kind of what was then called the Great Depression, before the other Great Depression came along. And in the 1870s and 80s and 90s, and the financial system was sort of reprivatized at that point, and the populists politically were just outmaneuvered and defeated. By the 1890s, they were sort of spent as a political force, and we were pretty much left with the situation we have today.
And you point out that there's a connection between the financing of war, the financing and the selling of war materials, and this privatized banking system.
The Civil War in the United States, there was a great need to fund, for war production, and it created great opportunities. The options for us right now, are we going to be ruled by Wall Street, or are we going to be ruled by Washington? And we've been ruled by Wall Street for quite a while now, and it looks like Wall Street has kind of run into a lot of trouble, and it looks like the bailouts and so forth. Are we really nationalizing the banks? Is that what's going to happen?
Well, you point out there are alternatives then. You discuss a man named Edward Kellogg and his ideas for a populist money system.
Well, right. The federal government took over the financial system. It wouldn't necessarily be an improvement, because you're still going to have a highly centralized, largely unaccountable system, prone to corruption and deal-making and lobbyists and all the rest of it. And we've already seen that with the TARP and so forth. So it's hard to have a lot of confidence in the government as an alternative. So you mentioned Edward Kellogg. He was a 19th century thinker, a kind of proto-populist. He died in 1858, and he wrote some interesting books. In a nutshell, he advocated decentralizing the monetary system, providing public credit locally, so that if I need to get a loan, I could go to my local government-regulated, but localized, not nationalized. I mean, there are national standards, but the issuance of money is local. I go get a loan from my local public credit bank in Kellogg system if I need to build a house or go to school or whatever I have to do. But the key thing is, Kellogg insisted that there be virtually no interest on these loans, that there was a nominal 1% interest.
So nobody would make money over the creation of money.
Well, the benefit of the loan would go to the lender rather than to the creditor.
So it would be a bottom-up finance system, which would parallel...
bottom-up financial system, and it's the economic sort of analog of the bottom-up political system, the confederal democracy we were discussing a few minutes ago.
So the government's role would be mainly to maintain a standard for the value of the currency, like a weights and measure, rather than to be the arbitrator of...
You got it exactly. That's what Kellogg said, that the instead of having a kind of something like a Federal Reserve or you still need, I guess, a Treasury Department for taxes and things, but the monetary system, the home of the monetary system would be exactly in the Department of Weights and Measures, Bureau of Standards, or whatever exactly it's called, so that the money would be defined. This is it gets kind of complicated in some respects. His idea was that the value of money is determined by the interest rate, and so he suggested a 1% interest rate to sort of cover expenses and make the system work and give it a little tiny bit of value, but not a usurious amount of value. And the 1% is an interesting thing, because it was also we were talking about the Romans earlier, in the early Christianity, the Council of Nicaea also came up with 1% as the maximum amount of interest that could be charged without going over into usury.
Right, because the system that we presently have does facilitate a concentration of wealth, and it also allows a small group of people an inordinate amount of power, you point out, because they can then control interest rates and they have influence over their political leadership. They can get inside information. And, of course, all the time they're making money, a profit, on loaning money to the government.
But the difficulty is that it's a self-defeating system in the long run. The system has to grow. There's been a lot of talk about Ponzi schemes with Bernoff, Madoff, and so forth, then the whole system might be characterized as a Ponzi scheme, because if you're lending money out, if all money depends on being repaid with interest, then you have to lend more and more money. So the money system is constantly expanding, which means that the people who borrow the money have to work that much harder to pay back the principal and pay back the interest before they can get any benefit at all. So this is really one of the chief engines, or has been one of the chief engines of economic growth. It goes back to the Bank of England in the 18th century, where the idea of credit, once you have credit sort of dominating the economy as opposed to sort of traditional, more static land-based economy, once you have credit dominating an economy has to grow, because it's in the nature of compound interest to grow. And it's an obligation. I mean, a debt is a legal obligation. You know, they can, you know, come and repossess your property and in the old days throw you in jail for not paying your debt. So it's a serious thing. And so we have this huge debt system now. By some estimates, it's $50, $60, $70 trillion or whatever. If you take household debt and government debt, including local governments and state governments and corporate debt, and you add all these things together, you've got this enormous thing that's several, you know, many times bigger than the actual economy. In other words, people are expecting to get repaid for all of this debt, and it's becoming increasingly more difficult and increasingly obvious, I think, that, you know, all these creditors are probably not going to be able to be repaid because the productive capacity of the base just isn't great enough to do it. So this is a very, very serious problem.
So the Kellogg system would eliminate that pyramiding of debt.
Yes, he saw it as a kind of self-regulating system. Money would be created at the local level on the basis of collateral. He wasn't giving money away. You had to borrow money. If you have something, you know, you have to have some resources to put down as collateral. You go borrow some money. You do what you need to do. You get the benefit of the debt because you don't have to pay high interest rates. And then as you pay back the debt, the money is automatically extinguished.
Well, now there is some precedent in American history for a non-private money system. You point out that some of the American colonies issued their own script.
Yes, the American colonies did this, especially in Pennsylvania, and it was very interesting. They were resisting the attempts of the City of London to control the finances, the financial system of the colonies, and to make money available only on these kind of usurious terms of interest. So, the number of colonies came up with the idea, well, why don't we just make our own money? And they did, and this was a contentious struggle, and eventually it was prohibited by Parliament. And this is a fascinating thing, because this is one of the least discussed causes of the American Revolution. You can look at a lot of textbooks and go to a lot of college lectures about the American Revolution, but you're not going to hear much about the role of money and finance in the American Revolution. So yes, there is this tradition in American history of local currencies or independent currencies resisting the idea of state centralized currencies. In those days, the Bank of England, today it would be our own Federal Reserve.
Well, now the hallmark of the populism seems to be decentralization of the economic and the political system. But let me give you an example. In our modern economy, a person might live in, say, New Jersey or Connecticut. He might spend his day working for a big corporation in New York City. His work itself may not relate in any way to his community. And his skills are maybe not skills that could translate into an economically independent business. How could we move from a society structured like that to one that would lend itself to a populist system?
Well, I don't think it's going to happen unless the current system has a very serious breakdown, which it may be having. I'm sort of a doomer about the current economic system. I don't see how borrowing more money and going further into debt, which is what the stimulus packages are all about, in the long run, just exacerbates the problem. So in the first instance, I think there's a very real prospect of a major breakdown. And if that occurs, then I think people will be thrown back onto more local resources. And that's going to be very difficult. It could be a very serious crisis. The Soviet Union's collapse in the 1990s, some people think sort of be a kind of foreshadowing of what we might be in for here. I don't think we can reform the current system as it stands just through the current political processes. So I think it's going to take a shock to the system to really force us to think outside the box and to look at some of these other alternatives. So I think it could be painful. But if we're thrown back onto our local resources and back onto our local communities, people look at things like growing maybe some food in their gardens and things like that, then I think this sort of idea of a bottom-up political and economic system begins to make sense. But I think we have to go through this crisis to be
honest. Well, let's suppose that we unfortunately enter a very long depression, period of low economic activity that starts to make people think that we need fairly significant changes in the way we organize our society. Where would you start? Where should the American people start to restructure in terms of perhaps constitutional changes?
We still have somewhat of a sense of being a federal system, and it may be that as things tend to devolve, if there's somewhat of a breakdown in, say, the global system of delivering food, you know, and clothes. I buy garlic in my local supermarket, but the garlic in my supermarket comes from China. Now, if that's not going to be sustainable, we need to work somehow towards a sustainable economic system, one in which our resources aren't being depleted at rates faster than they can be replenished, which goes back to the driving problem of the debt system that forces us to exploit our resources more. We've been living high off the hog for living memory, probably of any of the listeners here. And so it's a real crisis here. Unless we have a sense of something like a bottom-up, decentralized political and economic system, then when the crisis does hit, then I think we're going to be even less prepared than we are now.
Well, thank you very much for being with us today, Mr. Kuzminski. We've been talking to Adrian Kuzminski, author of Fixing the System, A History of Populism, Ancient and Modern. This is Ken McDermott Rowe, your host of History Counts, and I'll be right back. As Adrian Kuzminski explained, populists believe that wide disparities of wealth are incompatible with a democratic system of government. As a result, some people incorrectly associate populism with socialism. However, Mr. Kuzminski writes that the populist aim is not to redistribute property or achieve state ownership of the means of production. Rather, populism aims to provide people with access to resources, especially credit, so that they can be economically independent. The populist goal is a broad middle class existing in a private economic system where sole proprietorships and other small businesses would flourish. While populists strongly support private ownership, they're very critical of the present concentration of political and economic power in large corporations. According to Mr. Kuzminski, populists seek the disestablishment of corporate power, which they see as unaccountable to the public. This includes reversing the court-created fiction of corporate personhood, which a century ago endowed corporations with the same constitutional rights as people. Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration of Independence and third president of the United States, believed that the American Revolution was a good start, but just a start, and a long process to establish a true American democracy. Near the end of his life, Jefferson wrote this in a letter to his rival and friend, John Adams. The generation which commences a revolution rarely completes it. Thank you for joining us for today's edition of History Counts, Populism, the Third Way. History Counts is produced by MDR Productions, Inc., B.J. McDermott Rowe, Technical Director. Please visit us at historycounts.org, where you can listen for free to an archive of our programs, see a schedule of upcoming shows, and sign up for our monthly newsletter. Until next time, this is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts.